Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. First of all, I'd like to thank you for coming out to the Tattered Cover Bookstore and supporting your locally owned and independent booksellers. I'm pleased to introduce this evening's guest speaker, author Christopher Jansma. Christopher is a lecturer at Manhattanville College and SUNY Purchase and writes a monthly column for Electric Literature's blog. Tonight, he's here to present his debut novel, The Unchangeable Spots of Leopards. And I gotta say, it's really exciting to watch the book world get excited about a new author. And that's happened with Christopher. It's only been out, I think, just a week or so, and you've already got raving reviews from Booklist, Publishers Weekly, Library Journal. I was sent pages and pages and pages of fantastic reviews on the book. So my favorite thing that I've read so far, and it's a little quirky, but my favorite thing that I read so far is that this novel reads like an upside-down Candid. And so I am just about 90 pages into the book and enjoying it, and I hope you guys do as well. So please join me in welcoming Christopher Jansma.
Thank you so much. And I would want to say thanks everyone here for coming out and supporting Tattered Cover, one of the country's, probably the world's great independent bookstores. I've never been to Denver before, so this is a real honor for me to be reading here. She mentioned briefly my Electric Literature columns. I just wanted to say that one of the things I've been writing about for them a lot is our independent bookstores and how important it is to kind of keep on, focusing on that. So it's great. I'm hoping as soon as this book tour is over, I get a chance to sit down and write a whole column about all the great bookstores that I've seen. So so I'm Christopher Jansma. This is my debut novel. It's called The Unchangeable Spots of Leopards, and I don't really want to say too much about it. I don't want to give anything away, but it's a novel about two young writers, one of whom, the narrator, is desperately wants to write a great book, and he's struggling with that throughout the course of the book. His best friend is a unfortunately much more talented writer than he is, but maybe fortunately, or also unfortunately, highly unstable. So this is a chapter I haven't read from before, so I'm excited to get a chance to share with you guys tonight. Chapter 4 in the book is called Anton and I, and I'm going to read, I think if all goes well, I should be able to read through most of the chapter. I'm going to skip over just a couple of quick sections within the story here, within the chapter. There are a couple of excerpts from the novel that the very bad novel that the writer is the narrator is trying to write, and so I'm going to skip over those for tonight. But I hope you all buy the book and get a chance to read for yourself. And I should mention, by the way, very bad does not mean that it's like painful to read. It's just he talks in the chapter about why it's not quite up to snuff. So all right. So this is Anton and I. Winter winds howled through Union Square, and snow piled up in the night. There were no pathways, only the backs of benches and the tops of trash cans. Streetlights bent up like periscopes from beneath the tundra. The tree branches were limned with white, as were the fire escapes and all the little terracotta pots out on them. Each pot sheltered a lump of dead earth and the dry husk of plant life within it. From the window of Anton's apartment, I sipped some of his golden Zubrowka vodka and watched three figures crossing the park from different angles, heads bent and trudging slowly, carving lines that would not intersect. Rose lay on an oriental blue divan by the fireplace, her hair still pinned up from her rehearsal of The Cherry Orchard earlier that day. The only finished copy of my manuscript lay beside her in a heavy yellow hat box, which I'd borrowed from Anton as a means of transporting my pages to and from the public library each day. Every few moments, Rose pinched the corner of a new page with two fingers, as if it were a beloved photograph, and lifted it from the box. As she read, she rubbed her thumb softly against her latest engagement ring. This one was either from His Royal Highness Umberto, Prince of Greece and Denmark, or from Filippos V of the former Royal Italian House of Savoy. It got so hard to keep track, and I found it easiest to live with myself when I did not know who her suitors were. Through the thin paper, an orange glow outlined the shadow of her fingers as they scanned beneath my lines. Her deep brown eyes flitted from side to side, her lips occasionally cracked into a smile that sent my heart thumping, or they crept down into a puzzled frown that twisted my guts until I forced myself to gaze out the window again, hoping she would hurry and deliver me from my misery. Then the peaceful crackle of the electric fireplace was interrupted by deathly hacking from the neighboring bedroom. Anton hadn't been well in weeks. He'd wake up at odd hours and bang around the apartment while Rose and I were entangled in my room across the hall. In the morning, we'd find burned-down candles, handkerchiefs stained with phlegm and typewriter ink, and discarded containers of wonton soup, like artifacts for us to puzzle over. As Rose got to the last page, I looked out into the snowy darkness again. I could still see the immortal statue of General George Washington on his horse. Before its erection, the square had been a potter's field, and according to research I'd done for my novel, only the penniless had been buried there, and they'd hung criminals from the elms. Beneath all that snow and concrete and dead grass and damp earth lay the bodies of some 20,000 nameless men and women, forgotten before they'd even died. "Finished," Rose said, laying the last page on the divan beside her and stretching out like a lioness satisfied with the day's kill. "And?" I asked, reaching for the bottle of Zubrowka to refill my glass. Each bottle was adorned with a little brown bison and contained a single yellow blade of bison grass from the primeval Bielowska forest. Technically illegal in the States, the spirit was Anton's favorite reminder of his homeland. "And you're brilliant," she purred. "It's absolutely masterful." I came over next to her and set my glass down. "You're not just saying that?" "Would I lie?" she teased. Behind her dark eyes, folded up inside Rose's imagination, my characters were still alive, just as I'd described them. She scraped her ring gently against the back of my arm, liquor pulsed in my veins. Her head slowly moved into the orbit of my own. I kept my eyes open so I could see the gentle shake that comes when she's fighting herself and losing. And then, an inhuman rasping sound bursts forth from Anton's room, shattering the moment and all subsequent moments. The sound grew louder, and soon the door pushed open and Anton half-collapsed into the room, his bathrobe opened, his eyes as red as beets. "I'm dying," he announced. "Anton, dear, you have the flu," Rose said, for the 100th time that week. She got up to look after him. She'd been mothering him since long before I knew either of them, since they were 13 and both sent to live a continent away from their families at St. Albans Preparatory School. Quickly, I shuffled the remaining pages together and slipped them back into the hat box before Anton could see them. "Do you want us to order you more wonton soup?" "Damn the soup!" Anton bellowed, tossing a checkerboard sans pieces over the divan and against the window. "Damn all the soup!" "He's delirious," Rose said, chasing after him, trying to tie his robe together. "Melodramatic, you mean," I said, and we both knew it was more likely that he was drunk. Anton seemed to be offended by this. "There isn't a melodramatic bone in my body," he coughed, "and you ought to know the difference." He seemed eager to go on, but he erupted into another coughing fit that he covered only barely with his sleeve. When he pulled the sleeve away, we could both see that it was speckled with blood. "How long have you been coughing up blood?" Rose asked. Anton lifted one cupped hand high in the air. "It will have blood, they say. Blood will have blood." "What the hell is he doing?" "He's doing Macbeth," Rose said calmly, finding her phone in a voluminous handbag. "Anton, dear, sit down. I'm going to call your parents." "But they're out on the Crimean Peninsula somewhere," I said. "We've got to call an ambulance. We should have called one a week ago." I'd let this slide this long because Anton's nocturnal schedule wasn't all that unusual. We had always gone through long stretches when we were each so engrossed in our own writing that we barely spoke. I worked best during the harsh light of the morning, when my dreams from the night before still danced in my mind. Anton preferred to wake in blackness from nightmares and push them away slowly with sips of Zubrowka and taps of his Remington hammers on ink-soaked ribbons. Now, I felt that it was little wonder he'd gotten so sick. Every day, he waged new campaigns in the war against his own body. Rose ignored me and dialed 12 digits from memory. A moment later, she was connected to a palatial mansion on the Sea of Azov that I've heard about many times, but had never seen. Sorry, my Russian's a little rusty, but I'll give this a shot. Доброе утро, господин Пришибаев. Это Rose. Ваш сын Антон. Блин? She spoke in flawless Russian. As the one-sided conversation continued, Anton led me in a waltz around the room, pausing only briefly to mist his other sleeve with airborne blood. I wondered how contagious tuberculosis was, or if he might have gotten some kind of STD from one of his many gentlemen callers. Rose looked up, holding her hand over the receiver. Mr. Prishibayev says we should take him to see a Dr. Ivanich. He's a friend of the family's. Anton shouted, Pasha! Pasha, Pasha, Pasha! I didn't know what Pasha meant, but Dr. Ivan Ivanich's name I knew from the many bottles of Lodosil, the antidepressant that Anton took daily, as well as the various barbiturates and painkillers that were hidden further back in Anton's medicine cabinet. Yeah, great, Pasha, I said, coaxing Anton into the divan to lie down. I'll buzz down for a taxi. The doctor is ice fishing at his lake house, Rose informed me after a bit more Russian dialogue with Mr. Prishibayev, somewhere upstate. Wakabuk! Anton shouted suddenly. He's delirious, I said, laying the back of my hand on his forehead. Just tell his father we're going to take him to St. Vincent's. Как насчет, если мы возьмем его в больницу? Rose checked the time and then said to me, I have rehearsal for the cherry orchard in 6 hours. I can't go upstate tonight. Nobody can go upstate tonight. None of us has a car, for one thing. For another, there's 2 feet of snow on the ground. Wakabuk! What does that mean? Is he saying something in Russian? It's not Russian, she said to me. Then on the phone, Zizyes Minogo Snega. His son is coughing up blood, I continued. The man's 12 time zones away. Let's just go to the hospital. Rose shot me a tired look and whispered, He says to take the Jaguar in the garage down the street. It's for emergencies. He says his son has numerous rare conditions, and if you don't take Anton to see Dr. Ivan Ivanich at Lake Wakabuk, then he'll die, and Mr. Prishibayev will fly over here and kill you with his bare hands. And so it was settled. I got Anton into a too big overcoat and grabbed a mismatched wool cap and scarf for myself. Rose pushed the yellow hat box full of manuscript pages under my arm. More than anything, what I wanted to do now was read it all again, to relive in each and every detail that was now dancing around in her head. Masterful, she said again, as she gave me a quick kiss goodbye. Then, with Anton leaning heavily on my other arm, he and I trudged out into the worst storm in several years in search of the parking garage where Anton's father kept the for emergencies only Jaguar. It was times like these, which cropped up more often than they ought to, that I wondered why exactly Anton and I were friends at all. A sleepy Pakistani attendant unearthed a camel-colored X-300 from the bowels of the garage. The man seemed skeptical, double-checking Anton's crimson Russian passport, his only form of photo ID, and jabbering in Urdu while motioning at the snow at the mouth of the garage. I tipped him $100 out of Anton's wallet, and the attendant reluctantly handed over the keys. Soon, Anton was dozing in the passenger seat, and I was guiding the Jaguar through a maze of plowed streets, going the wrong way on 6th Avenue only briefly before finding my way onto West Street. There I found 4 empty, freshly plowed lanes and the great frozen Hudson to the left. It was a challenge keeping the sports car under 30 miles an hour, and I could only barely see the red lights that I was running. A few snow plows passed in the other lane, but otherwise, I had the roads almost entirely to myself. A good thing, because I hadn't driven since high school and was feeling the effects of the Zubrowka. Fumbling with the radio controls in the dark, I managed to get the tape deck on. The only music available seemed to be a scratchy recording of Zero Mostel in Fiddler on the Roof. I hadn't suspected Mr. Prishibayev to be a fan of Broadway musicals. As we passed the George Washington Bridge, I listened to Tevye sing about tradition, accompanied by Anton's faint dream humming, and drifted back into thoughts of my novel. Titled Just Before the Gilded Age, it was about a young southern gilder in the late 1800s in Manhattan who falls in love with the daughter of a railroad tycoon. I was going to dedicate it to Rose as a wedding present if she gave me no other option. We were past Fort Tryon Park and rising up out of the city. Soon I found I could not keep my eyes open another second, so I pulled off the highway under the shelter of an overpass. I checked the time on my watch and decided to skim through the final pages of my novel until I woke up a little. The next thing I knew, I was shivering in the pale light of early morning, and Anton was awake. What happened? I asked, snapping forward sharply into the leather-wrapped steering wheel. My eyes were so glazed over that I could barely see. Apparently, Anton said dryly, you tried to kidnap me and steal my father's car and fell asleep in the middle of the getaway. You were dying, you were coughing up blood, and Anton protested, even as he let out another long, hacking cough. I'm from Russia. This is my natural state of being. What, you think I have tuberculosis? Consumption? Like some character in this terrible thing?
Suddenly, my eyes focused on the pile of papers on his lap, and I twisted around to find the yellow hat box, violated, on the back seat. "Who said you could read that?" I grabbed the pilfered pages away from him. I felt my heart pounding harder. Back in our college days, Anton had written a story, not entirely unlike this one, about his great-grandfather, and for many years now, I'd feared his reactions when he realized I was somewhat stealing his story. He seemed, if anything, amused, hardly what I'd been expecting. "I'll wake up to your next to your snoring body in a car with a dead battery in the middle of nowhere. What else am I supposed to do to pass the time?" "Dead battery?" "Yes, I know Fiddler is enchanting, but perhaps you could have turned it off before you tucked in for the night?" Anxious to escape him, I shoved my door open and stepped out into the side of the road. We were on the side of the small sawmill parkway. The snow had stopped, at least, and I waved at some approaching cars, hoping to find someone with jumper cables. Anton got out of the car. "Aren't there perfectly good hospitals in Manhattan?" "That's what I said, but Rose called your dad, and he said that you had some rare..." "Preposterous," he shouted, "condition, and that we had to go see Dr. Ivanich at his lake house. And I thought you were, you know, dying, so it seemed like we'd better get on it." Six cars sped past before a rusted blue Suburban slowed to a stop, blocking half the neighboring lane. A large gentleman with a raccoon's beard leaned through his passenger side window. "You got cables?" he asked. I looked hopefully at Anton, who shrugged, possibly not even sure what jumper cables were. "We don't know," I admitted. The raccoon man seemed to consider leaving us there, but it was clear he thought it was too fine a piece of British engineering and didn't deserve to be stuck in Yonkers with two idiots like us. "She's a beaut," the man said. "Pop the hood and check your trunk for cables." Anton fumbled around in the front looking for a latch for the hood. I popped the trunk, where I found two huge crates marked heavily in Cyrillic. The only English I could find was on the customs declaration, which read, "Prishibayev Caviar, Sea of Azov." Beside these was a complete roadside safety kit, thankfully, including jumper cables. I delivered them to the raccoon man. Anton was searching for his cell phone, which was ringing, the aria that ends the first act of Eugene Onegin. Suddenly, I realized the phone was in the pocket of his coat, which I was wearing. "I'll get it," I said. "You start your car." I answered the phone as Westchesterians honked and flipped me the bird as I nervously flailed at the traffic to go around us. "Where are you?" Rose asked, her voice warming me deep down to my toes. "We're coming back. Anton is back to his usual charming self again." Had he really called my novel terrible? "Anton's father keeps calling me for updates. You'd better take him the rest of the way up there." Through the phone, I could hear Rose instructing a taxi driver to head up Madison Avenue to avoid construction. "Where are you going?" I asked. "The tea room," she said after a pause. "I'm meeting someone." "I thought you had a rehearsal." Rose mumbled something to someone else in the cab with her, and somehow I knew that she was with her prince. "It's been canceled because of all the snow," she lied. "If the cabs were running, then the show, as it were, would be going on, and she would never miss a rehearsal, which could only mean that there had never been one scheduled at all. She'd lied to get me out of town." I felt sick. There was a shout, either of panic or pain, and the roar of the Jaguar's engine, followed by the booming bass of Tevye at the end of Sunrise Sunset. "Gotta go," I said quickly. I heard her hesitate as if there were something else that she'd been just about to say, but then she said simply, "Goodbye," and hung up. Anton was trying to tip the raccoon man when I came running back up to the car. "Let's go," I barked at him, "before someone takes a shot at us." And so we eased out into the honking river of cars and headed up the highway again. As we drove in silence, I imagined pulling a U-turn through a break in the divider and heading back down to the Russian tea room to duel with whichever prince it was. Maybe it would move Rose to stay with me. Maybe I'd get shot and my novel would be published posthumously to great acclaim. Either way, it didn't sound like a bad plan compared with sitting next to Anton for another minute. "It's nice to get out to the country for a change," Anton said, reclining a little in his seat. I ignored him. Anton pretended he didn't care what was bothering me for about 5 minutes, at which point he simply couldn't resist anymore. "Troubles with Rose," he mocked. "Is the Prince of Dulcevania back in town?" Though I was sorely tempted to sink into a long, disparaging discussion of Rose's latest fiancé, a subject which Anton never tired of, I ignored the jab. "Rose is fine. She loved my book, by the way." "Oh, is that your problem? Of course she loved it. It's practically about her." Another long and stony silence as I sped through the thin traffic, angrier and angrier towards the next exit. "I never meant you couldn't fix it," he said finally. "You've got a perfectly serviceable first draft." "You said it was terrible, and it's my sixth draft." Anton reached back for the hat box. "Well, I only got through part of it. Let me take another look." "Leave it," I shouted. As we came into some small town, I suddenly wondered why I was even still driving. For weeks, I'd barely heard from Anton, only finding little messes around the apartment in the morning and hearing death rattles through the walls, and here I was, motoring him up to the Siberian wastelands of Westchester to see some quack, right after he'd insulted a year's worth of my work. "Screw this," I said, seeing a sign for the train station up ahead. "I'm going to go back to the city." I checked the time on my watch and figured that if I caught a train in the next half hour, I'd be back in time to make it to the Russian tea room. I wondered if it was still considered regicide if the prince in question had already been deposed. All I knew was that I didn't want to be stuck in a car with Anton a minute longer, listening to Tevye ask Goldie, "Do you love me?" "I suppose I do," she sang. "And I suppose I love you too," he replied. "You can't leave me here," Anton said, looking around at the quaint little nearby shops, the sunny exterior of Patty's funeral home, the shuttered yarn barn, and a busy little diner named Silly Nick's. To him, these may as well have been the gates of to the gulags. "I don't have a license," Anton added. "I don't even know how to drive." We slowed to a stop at a red light and watched a family of brightly colored fleece jackets crossing to get breakfast at Silly Nick's. "You keep a Jaguar in a garage and you don't know how to drive?" Anton didn't seem to understand why this wasn't logical. "It's my father's car, which he left here for you to use in case of emergencies, with two crates of caviar in the trunk for safekeeping." At the mention of the caviar, Anton's face lit up, and he suddenly opened his car door and scrambled around to the back. "Get back in the damn car," I shouted. The light turned green, and I had to set the car in park so I could run out after him. For the second time in an hour, I found myself standing in front of a line of furious drivers, thanks to Anton. But Anton was exuberant in front of the open trunk. "I thought I'd lost these. My father is practically going to disinherit me over them." "Where did you think you had lost them?" Anton, again, didn't seem to understand the question. Crates of caviar, in his world, were perfectly capable of falling in and out of existence. Before I could stop him, he had grabbed the tire iron and pried a crate open. The car's horns behind us were composing a collective atonal symphony. Though I was still stinging from what he'd said about my novel, I couldn't help but begin laughing at the sight of stringy Anton dangling in midair as he tried to use his full weight to open the crate. At least he was earnest about things, even his abject helplessness. He had everything in the world and could do almost nothing for himself. Gesturing rudely for the cars to drive around us, I rushed over to lend my weight to Anton's lever arm. With a great splintering sound, the lid burst off. Inside were stacks and stacks of golden caviar tins, painted with pale blue maps of the Sea of Azov. Anton grabbed two of the pressurized tins with a loud cheer, and we rushed back to the car and got safely over to the side of the road across from the train station. Scooping out the large brownish pearls of caviar with our fingers, we sat on the hood of the Jaguar and watched the traffic roll by. For a while, I waited for an apology, until I remembered that the word sorry was not in Anton Prishibayev's vocabulary. "Do you think Silly Nick's has blinis?" Anton asked, his mouth full of fish eggs. "No, I do not." "And you people call this the land of the free," he shouted at the commuters. "They call this Westchester." Three children leaned out the window of a yellow school bus to point at us. Anton's hair had brushed out in all directions, and his overcoat, which I had given back to him, was two sizes too big. My wool cap had slid back, and I was wrapped in a large red scarf and my threadbare old blazer. We must have looked like two hobos perched on a hood of a $100,000 car sucking fish eggs from our fingertips. The chorus of Fiddler rang out. "We know that when good fortune favors two such men, it stands to reason we deserve it too." How much does this stuff cost?" I asked, wishing I had some more Zubrowka to wash it down with. "And if our good fortune never comes, here's to whatever comes. These big tins are about 2,000, depending on how the ruble is doing." I choked and sputtered, inadvertently spraying $50 worth of caviar onto the icy pavement. "Ours is Ossetra caviar," Anton explained, beginning the inevitable lecture. "Molossal, which means a lightly salty flavor, large and relatively dark. Darkness is typically a mark of inferiority, but ours contains a particular nuttiness that is unique to this terroir. The Sea of Azov is actually the shallowest sea in the world, and this makes our sturgeons particularly nutty for some reason." "Not just your sturgeons," I joked. For that, I received a flicking of eggs in the face, but I couldn't resist another. "You know, it's not at all surprising that you come from the shallowest sea on Earth." Anton leaped from the hood and started to come after me. After a few moments' chase around the car, soon also speckled with fish eggs, we began shouting along with the tape deck in the car, "Drink, L'chaim, to life." Soon full, Anton curled up in his seat and closed his eyes. He was out like a light. Cursing myself a little for letting him off the hook so easily, I reached back into the hat box, eager to finish rereading my novel's terrible ending. All right. And I think I'm going to wrap up there. So you guys will have to keep on reading to see if he makes it. But they are almost to their destination. Thanks very much. All right. I forgot to ask before I started whether or not anybody here spoke Russian or knew the lyrics to Fiddler on the Roof, so that I wouldn't be too embarrassed if I butchered both of those. But anyway, I'd love to answer any questions if anybody has. Sure.
So you've been published in a lot of literary magazines before the novel. Mm-hmm. Did this start as a short story, or was this already a novel that you had in progress?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little bit of a long story, but I'll tell the short version. Basically, I had been trying really hard to write a novel for several years. I had worked on three different books that had all, for one reason or another, just totally fallen apart in my hands, basically. And so I decided, this was early in 2009, I sort of decided maybe the key was to go back to fundamentals and try writing short stories again, which I hadn't done in quite a while at that point, since I'd left graduate school. About 4 years earlier, 5 years earlier. And so I decided to start writing short stories. And then what I decided I would do is write 40 stories in a year, which was a little bit of a crazy thing to try to do. But I thought what I'd do is basically take, you know, each week and I try to write a story. I do that for 3 weeks in a row. And then I would take a little break and then go back and then the next three, write three new stories. And it went pretty well for the beginning. I would write a story, I'd throw it up online, my friends would read it. And they'd, you know, mostly tell me just, you know, hey, that was good. Nothing more sophisticated critique than that. But it was encouraging. And they also harassed me a little bit when I didn't get a story written over the course of a week. And then, you know, I'd have to get back on the ball and finish it. Anyway, as the process went on, I found myself working more seriously on these short stories. And then suddenly it was early April, it was week 13 in the whole process. I wrote a short story called The Unchangeable Spots of Leopards, and it was about these three characters who were going to out to brunch and sort of just focused on kind of the way that they're all sort of stuck with one another and trying really hard to move beyond one another and not being able to. And as soon as I finished that story, I sort of knew, you know, oh no, I've managed to start another novel after all. So what I ended up doing was then, you know, I still wanted to finish the stories, so I decided to continue with the project. And then the following week, I wrote actually the chapter that I just read to you guys today. The week after that, I wrote another chapter that wound up being a later part of the book. And then over the course of the rest of the year, I think I wrote about eight stories that ultimately wound up in this novel. And after that was all over, it took still about another year to you know, finish tying the pieces together and to rewrite everything so that it feels like a novel instead of, you know, a collection of linked stories, which is sort of how it started out. At this point, I do think it reads start to finish as if it, you know, were seamless. So, yeah, thanks. Hi.
Well, I like your pace, man. It's riffy.
The pace of my reading you enjoy? Oh, thank you.
It's riffy. I'm into improvisation. And I wondered, what's your process of thinking in terms of pace, and how often do you go back and change something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the question was whether or not, you know, sort of what the process of the pacing was for writing the individual chapters and how often I might go back and change something. That first story, as I was just saying, actually the characters are having brunch at a hotel that still does sort of a weekly jazz brunch. One of the reasons that I did that in the first chapter was because I'd been listening to a lot of jazz music and I'd been thinking a lot about improvisation.
edition. And I think it was actually the nature of that 40 stories project, because each week I would sort of take a couple of scattered thoughts and sort of try to throw them together and improvise a story out of them. And I think that's why it takes on that feeling. Because each week I was basically trying to make something up on the fly. And I've always appreciated it. I always loved that about jazz music. There's something, revolutionary about it, I think, you get to kind of reinvent what's possible when you're doing that. And that's one of the things that I wanted to do with this book. So each week I didn't have enough time to really sit and worry about, what are the rules? How do I make sure that this doesn't break any rules? Just decided to, kind of follow the inspiration of jazz and just kind of run with it and see where it led. So. Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you. Great question. Anybody else?
So you managed to pull out one novel from the short story.
Yes, yeah.
And as I said in the introduction, you've got the eye of a lot of reviewers, mm-hmm. and that does not always happen for first-time authors. So I'm wondering if you already have a contract for...
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll start with the second question you asked, which was how did the novel wind up getting so much buzz so early on? And I think part of the process was definitely thanks to the people at Viking who published it. They read it, and it was a little bit of an underdog story at first. I had several different agents before I met the one that I'm working with now, Chelsea Lindman, and then she read it and she loved it, and everybody was a little worried that, it's a novel that deals with writers and writing, which I'd heard from several agents who told me, it's just not possible. People don't read books about writers writing. Even though this book is really great, we just, don't see it happening. And Chelsea read the book and really believed in it. And she felt, this is so much more than a novel about writers, and it would be interesting to more people than just other writers. So she got it out there, and we had to kind of fight every step of the way, but we found a great young editor at Viking named Maggie Riggs. She fell in love with the book. She fought tooth and nail the whole way through the process to get it there. And what ended up happening as a result of that was it sort of turned into the little book that could, I guess. Everyone there was talking about this book that you had to read. And then after that, we started sending it out. We got a lot of great blurbs from people, and I think people were surprised by the great other writers who read it and loved it and wanted to support it, and so steadily over the course of the last year or two, I think it's been getting out there, and it's the kind of book that when you read it once, I've heard from a lot of people, several people have told me, you almost just want to start the whole thing over again. You want to tell other people about it, I think, because you want somebody to talk to about it. So I think it's been spreading virally, kind of word of mouth, and hopefully I'll continue to do that. Yeah. Yes. So the legend here is true. The question was whether or not people at Viking were actually sort of leaving copies of the book lying around for strangers to find. And we did do that, actually. It was an idea that I came up with a little bit. We were I had heard from a random reader in San Francisco, got in touch with me on Facebook, and he said, I was in a cafe in, I forget where, in San Francisco, in the Mission District, and I found a copy of your novel lying here on the counter, and I wondered if it was okay. I read it, I really enjoyed it, and I was wondering if it's okay. I know it's an advanced copy, but could I share it with a friend of mine? I think that she would like it too. And so I told the people at Viking about that, and they thought it was so funny, and they said, that would be so great. We should start doing that. So we took, maybe I think about 10 different copies. We sent them out to friends of ours all around the country, and we had them leave them in cafes and libraries and places like that, places where readers would find them. And then we put a little note, you know, in there, you know, if you found this book, you know, please enjoy it and let us know that you found it and where you found it. Just kind of wanted to see, you know, how that word of mouth thing would work. And we did hear back from some people who found the book, and it's this little treasure. There's a joke and it's sort of built into it as well. The first line of the novel is the narrator saying in his author's note, "I've lost every book I've ever written," and the novel involves him explaining how he loses three different books over the course of the story here. So it kind of fit in thematically with what was going on. Yeah. So yeah. Any other questions? Oh, your earlier question was from all those other stories, is there another novel in the works? There is, actually, from that same year when I was working on the first few stories of this book. I wrote another story about a group of young people living in New York that very different types of characters from these and much different tone, a little bit more of like a realistic tone to those stories, and struggling to deal with sort of group of five young people struggling to deal with mortality and loss. I can't say too much more than that because we haven't actually sold it yet. So we're still trying to get people interested in it, where people at Viking are looking at it now. So they've only had it for a few weeks. I'm very excited about it. And I think it's going to be a good second book. I'm eager to get back into it.
What are the letters?
The question: What are the letters on the front on the book jacket? The beautiful cover design here by Allison Forner at Viking, which I had no part in. They did a beautiful job and all on their own. They're meant to look like typewriter keys. And there's a story later on in the novel where he's with the main characters trying to write a short story on a typewriter in Iceland that has sort of strange keys and missing letters and things like that. And I think that's where the idea came from, but we liked it as an image because, they look like spots, I think. And also it feels like a puzzle, you know, there's some sort of code or riddle in there, which is, I think the experience of reading the book is like you're trying to, it's a book that you become absorbed in and want to solve in a way. So, yeah. We were a little concerned when we first picked it because we showed it to some of the very youngest people, not at Viking, but some younger people, and they looked at them and they said, "What are those?" And we said, "They're typewriter keys." And they said, "Oh, I've never seen a typewriter before." And we're like realizing that reference is maybe passing, but anyway, still looks good. Yeah. Yeah. I learned to type on a typewriter even before I had a computer. So yeah. Any other questions I can answer? No. All right. Well, thank you guys again so much for coming out and for listening to the reading. I hope you enjoy the rest of it. If you pick up a copy, I'd be happy to sign it for you here. And thank you again for supporting Tattered Cover, one of our greatest independent bookstores.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.